So, friends, I like to wait for the bell to stop ringing often when I offer a reflection after I sit. But that would take a really long time with this bell. It's still going for those of you up in front. So, since I only have a little less than 15 minutes, I'm talking over its resonance. But to also say something that's lingering in my mind and heart is that we are now halfway through a five-part series on the five faculties, five spiritual faculties, the five indriya, they're called. And the first two were faith or confidence and energy or effort. And the third, which is the fulcrum, the middle point of the scale or the center of the teeter-totter, is sati, lucid awareness, mindfulness. So I'll start with a little bit of a story, very short story. The Buddha's cousin Ananda was, they were very dear to each other. Ananda kind of shadowed the Buddha for decades as the Buddha taught. He was his personal attendant, friend. And also had the task back in that oral history time of ancient India of remembering all of the Buddha's teachings. He had eidetic memory, perfect memory. Quite a skill to have. This was before we had the Zoom recordings or anything like it, right? And so he was probably closer than anyone else to the Buddha. And at the time of the Buddha's death, Ananda became very sad, disconsolate, just grieving. And he knew it was his responsibility to show up at a large sort of Mahasangha, great Sangha meeting of all of the awakened ones, the fully awakened ones, shortly after the Buddha's death, because he was the one who could recite everything and make sure that it was correct, because everyone trusted his memory. So, with his aching heart, he determined to practice really assiduously, really hard to fully awaken. He had been so busy serving the Buddha that he was mostly awake, but not totally awake, I guess, to use the technical terminology. And so he sat and walked and sat and walked, and it wasn't happening. It was not happening. And so late into the night, he finally let go, went into his hut, and went to lay down. And as the story goes, between the time he leaned over to the bed and the time his head hit the pillow, he completely woke up. Wow. In kind of a dramatic way. I won't go into all the details for time. And so he went to the meeting early the next morning. I don't know how many hours of sleep he got, not many. And it was just clear from his entrance to everyone there that he was awakened. They could tell it radiated from him. And one of the things that he shared with his peers, among many in that long meeting, was that his own refuge, now that the Buddha had died, and the refuge that the Buddha recommended after his death was mindfulness of the body. Mindfulness of the body. So I just want to really emphasize this, that mindfulness grounded in embodied experience is so powerful that the Buddha himself recommended it as a refuge after his death. And Ananda, who loved the Buddha dearly, found it to be a refuge after his death. It can be a refuge even in times of grief. Major transition. And it also has this powerful quality of balancing energies, balancing the spiritual faculties of faith, confidence, energy, or effort. And then those are energizing faculties. And then there are the other two, which we'll cover next week and the week after, which are the calming, settling faculties of samadhi and of wisdom. So this corrective quality is likened to being like, and here we're talking about ancient India, being a charioteer, the driver of a chariot. And the four horses are these four other qualities. And mindfulness is responsible for helping them all pull in the same direction and not at cross purposes to one another, but all together, harmoniously. And to do this, mindfulness involves dimensions beyond what's often talked about in the popular mindfulness movement or even in MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, and in sort of popular and secular parlance. There's this beautiful definition Jon Kabat-Zinn gave, which I'm going to paraphrase, that being aware on purpose of what's happening while it's happening in a non-judgmental way. And that is powerful all on its own. It is one facet, one dimension of the kind of mindfulness we're talking about here. It's an important dimension. Another one, which is much less talked about, but it's all over the place in the teachings. I actually dug back through the ancient discourses preparing for this to make sure, is to remember. To recollect, remember both past, long past, and within a meditation session, what's happened immediately before, or what happened, and how it links up with what's happening now. So, the distinction between this, because you've all heard Dharma teachers say, and I've said, don't get lost in the past, don't get stuck in the story, don't go off, down memory lane or in worries in the future. This kind of recollection happens with clear knowledge that remembering is happening in the moment. So it's noticing the cause and effect in the moment. It ripens to a kind of maturity, a kind of wisdom all on its own, a different kind of wisdom than the fifth faculty. It comes to be this kind of wisdom and recollection as the mindfulness begins to gain a little momentum. So maybe you've had a few seconds or a few minutes, even an hour of just being present. It's that kind of presence that allows this capacity to emerge. And it develops naturally over time. And eventually it matures to something that the Buddha talks about in the four foundations of mindfulness: the body, including the breath, feeling tones, how things feel, pleasant, unpleasant, the mind, and all the stuff in the mind. Those are all establishments of mindfulness practices that we do. And as those establishments, those foundations get firm, then a practitioner abides in mindfulness. You're not doing anymore, just resting. And the mindfulness kind of takes over. It has its own quality. You may notice this at moments throughout your day that every once in a while, for no reason at all, no good reason you can think of, poof, you're aware. Oh, I'm aware of what's happening, while it's happening. That is the momentum of the practice beginning to reach its fingers into the other corners of your life. And it can happen on the cushion or in the chair as well. The momentum of the mindfulness being able to reach further and further into all the different dimensions of experience. So, mindfulness starts and sometimes stays. Sometimes meditation is manual labor, right? As something we do, bringing the mind back over and over. Are days like that for all of us, even Dharma teachers. And as it gains momentum, when the conditions are right, it begins to have its own wisdom and it begins to have a quality of emergence, of being able to settle back and abide in it. It is In all of these cases, it has the capacity to be that wise balancing point between energized or over-energized and settled or overly calm. So notice this week. Notice when the awareness is there, when it's not. And maybe in your practice, notice when, oh, feels a little too energized or feels a little too down. If putting a little bit more attention on the mindfulness itself, the awareness itself, might just bring everything back into balance. Help the horses pull in the same direction. So thank you for your attention. We have a couple of announcements. So I'll start with one that's timely. It is very rare, friends, that I announce something that is not based in this center, not Donna, not donation, but our friends at the Wisdom Center and our dear friend and colleague Tenzin Choki is starting an 8-week class tonight, a compassion cultivation training. And there are still spots available. So if you want to register, you can go to the Wisdom Center's website or you can show up and register there. It is a fee tuition situation. So check the website if that's a concern for you. But I will say from personal experience, I took this class after already being a very deep practitioner. And it was consequential. It was deeply, deeply transformative. So high recommendation. And announcements from the Sangha.
So last week when I talked about Donna, I suggested looking at the calendar. So I took myself up on the suggestion. And I was so heartened by everything that we provide here. Seven teachers, I think it's 16 leaders and a full board. And also, April itself had 28 days of opportunities for practicing, and sometimes two or three events a day. And that goes on every month, but I just only looked at April. And I also found that there's, donating time. There's weekly home visits and calls one can make. Errands need to be done. Sitting with those who can't come into the center but would like to sit with a partner or another Sangha member, as well as providing a meal and offering rides to and from here. So there's lots of opportunity and ways in how we give, whether it's monetarily to keep the center going with all those classes and events, as well as your time. So I encourage you again to take a look at the. Oh, there was one other thing that really caught my eye. That was the new Friday evening, the youth Sangha.
It's not evenings, it's noon.
It's at noon.
Yeah.
So people from 17 to 35 year olds, I think, another opportunity for youth and people in your life you might want to mention too. So thank you, and hope you can find the ways to give that's in your heart. Thank you, Dawn.
Thank you, Tess.
Thank you, Tess.
So may all of us experience the joys and benefits of generosity, of spirit, of practice, of whatever kind. And may all beings benefit from the generosity of our practice. Thank you all. See you next week.
Thank you, Dawn. It was
very cool.
Thank you.
To the hand.
You can come down here.
Evie, it was spontaneous. Be well.
Watch. Okay, see my hand. Now it's up.
Oh.